wanted to learn about Tengo as a person, his experience growing up, what he was doing now. Tengo explained himself as honestly as he could. He was born in the city of Ichikawa in nearby Chiba Prefecture. His mother died of an illness shortly after he was born, or at least that was what his father told him. He had no siblings. His father never remarried, but raised Tengo by himself, collecting NHK television subscription fees door to door to make a living. Now, however, his father had Alzheimer's disease and was living in a nursing home on the southern tip of Chiba's Boso Peninsula. Tengo himself had graduated from Tsukuba University's oddly named School One College of Natural Studies Mathematics major, and was writing fiction while teaching mathematics at a private cram school in Yoyogi. At the time of his graduation, he could have taken a position at a prefectural high school near home, but instead he chose the relatively free schedule of the Tokyo cram school. He lived alone in a small apartment in the Koenji district west of downtown Tokyo, which gave him an easy half-hour commute to school. Tengo did not know for certain whether he wanted to be a professional novelist, nor was he sure he had the talent to write fiction. What he did know was that he could not help spending a large part of every day writing fiction. To him, writing was like breathing. Komatsu said practically nothing as he listened to Tengo's story. He seemed to like Tengo, though it was not clear why. Tengo was a big man. He had been a key member of his judo team in middle school, high school, and college, and he had the eyes of an early waking farmer. He wore his hair short, seemed always to have a tan, and had cauliflower ears. He looked neither like a youthful devotee of literature nor like a teacher of mathematics, which was also something that Komatsu seemed to like about him. Whenever Tengo finished a story, he would take it to Komatsu. Komatsu would read it and offer his comments. Tengo would rewrite it, following his advice, and bring it to Komatsu again, who would provide new instructions, like a coach raising the bar a little at a time. "Your case might take some time," he said, "but we're in no hurry. Just make up your mind to write every single day, and don't throw anything out. It might come in handy later." Tengo agreed to follow Komatsu's advice. For his part, Komatsu would occasionally send small writing jobs Tengo's way. Anonymously, Tengo wrote copy for the women's magazine produced by Komatsu's publisher. He handled everything, revising letters to the editor, writing background pieces on movies and books, composing horoscopes. His horoscopes were especially popular because they were often right. Once when he wrote, "Beware an early morning earthquake," there actually was a big earthquake early one morning. Tengo was grateful for the extra income and for the writing practice this work provided. It made him happy to see his writing in print, in any form, displayed in the bookstores. Eventually, Tengo was hired as a screener for the literary magazine's New Writers Prize. It was odd for him to be screening other writers' works when he himself was competing for the prize, but he read everything impartially, not terribly concerned about the delicacy of his situation. If nothing else, the experience of reading mounds of badly written fiction gave him an indelible lesson in exactly what constituted badly written fiction. He read around 100 works each time, choosing 10 that might have some point to them to bring to Komatsu with written comments. 5 works would make it to the shortlist, and from those, the 4-person committee would select the winner. Tengo was not the only part-time screener, and Komatsu was only one of several editors engaged in assembling the shortlist. This was all in the name of fairness, but such efforts were not really necessary. No matter how many works were entered in the competition, there were never more than 2 or 3 of any value, and no one could possibly miss those. 3 of Tengo's stories had made the shortlist in the past. Each had been chosen not by Tengo himself, of course, but by 2 other screeners, and then by Komatsu, who manned the editorial desk. None had won the prize, but this had not been a crushing blow to Tengo. For one thing, Komatsu had ingrained in him the idea that he just had to give it time, and Tengo himself was not all that eager to become a novelist right away. If he arranged his teaching schedule well, Tengo was able to spend 4 days a week at home. He had taught at the same cram school for 7 years now, and he was popular with the students because he knew how to convey the subject succinctly and clearly, and he could answer any question on the spot. Tengo surprised himself with his own eloquence. His explanations were clever, his voice carried well, and he could excite the class with a good joke. He had always thought of himself as a poor speaker, and even now he could be at a loss for words when confronted face to face. In a small group, he was strictly a listener. In front of a large class, however, his head would clear, and he could speak at length with ease. His own teaching experience gave him renewed awareness of the inscrutability of human beings. Tengo was not dissatisfied with his salary. It was by no means high, but the school paid in accordance with ability. The students were asked to do course evaluations periodically, and compensation hinged on the results. The school was afraid of having its best teachers lured away, and in fact, Tengo had been headhunted several times. This never happened at ordinary schools. There, salary was set by seniority. Teachers' private lives were subject to the supervision of administrators, and ability and popularity counted for nothing. Tengo actually enjoyed teaching at the cram school. Most of the students went there with the explicit purpose of preparing for the college entrance exams, and they attended his lectures enthusiastically. Teachers had only one duty, to teach their classes. This was exactly what Tengo wanted. He never had to deal with student misbehavior or infractions of school rules. All he had to do was show up in the classroom and teach students how to solve mathematical problems. And the manipulation of pure abstractions using numerical tools came naturally to Tengo. When he was home, Tengo usually wrote from first thing in the morning until the approach of evening. All he needed to satisfy him was his Mont Blanc pen, his blue ink, and standard manuscript sheets, each page lined with 400 empty squares ready to accept 400 characters. Once a week, his married girlfriend would come to spend the afternoon with him. Sex with a married woman 10 years his senior was stress-free and fulfilling, because it couldn't lead to anything. As the sun was setting, he would head out for a long walk, and once the sun was down, he would read a book while listening to music. He never watched television. Whenever the NHK fee collector came, he would point out that he had no television set and politely refused to pay. "I really don't have one. You can come in and look if you want," he would say. But the collector would never come in. They were not allowed to. "I have something bigger in mind," Komatsu said. "Something bigger. Much bigger. Why be satisfied with small-scale stuff like the new writer's prize? As long as we're aiming, why not go for something big?" Tengo fell silent. He had no idea what Komatsu was getting at, but he sensed something disturbing. "The Akutagawa Prize," Komatsu declared after a moment's pause. "The Akutagawa Prize," Tengo repeated the words slowly, as if he were writing them in huge characters with a stick on wet sand. "Come on, Tengo, you can't be that out of touch. The Akutagawa Prize, every writer's dream. Huge headlines in the paper, TV news." "Now you're losing me. Are we still talking about Fukaeri?" "Of course we are, Fukaeri and Air Chrysalis. Have we been discussing anything else?" Tengo bit his lip as he tried to fathom the meaning behind Komatsu's words. "But you yourself said there's no way Air Chrysalis can take the new writer's prize. Haven't we been talking about that all along, how the work will never amount to anything the way it is?"
"Precisely. It'll never amount to anything the way it is. That is for certain."
Tengo needed time to think. "Are you saying it needs to be revised?"
"It's the only way. It's not that unusual for an author to revise a promising work with the advice of an editor. It happens all the time. Only, in this case, rather than the author, someone else will do the revising."
"Someone else?" Tengo asked, but he already knew what Komatsu's answer would be.
"You."
Tengo searched for an appropriate response, but couldn't find one. He heaved a sigh and said, "You know as well as I do that this work is going to need more than a little patching here and there. It'll never come together without a fundamental top-to-bottom rewrite.
which is why you'll rewrite it from top to bottom. Just use the framework of the story as is, and keep as much of the tone as possible. But change the language, a total remake. You'll be in charge of the actual writing, and I'll be the producer.
Just like that, Tengo muttered, as if to himself.
Look, Komatsu said, picking up a spoon and pointing it at Tengo the way a conductor uses his baton to single out a soloist from the rest of the orchestra. This Fukaeri girl has something special. Anyone can see it reading Air Chrysalis. Her imagination is far from ordinary. Unfortunately, though, her writing is hopeless, a total mess. You, on the other hand, know how to write. Your storylines are good. You have taste. You may be built like a lumberjack, but you write with intelligence and sensitivity, and real power. Unlike Fukaeri, though, you still haven't grasped exactly what it is you want to write about, which is why a lot of your stories are missing something at the core. I know you've got something inside you that you need to write about, but you can't get it to come out. It's like a frightened little animal hiding way back in a cave. You know it's in there, but there's no way to catch it until it comes out, which is why I keep telling you, just give it time.
Tengo shifted awkwardly on the booth's vinyl seat. He said nothing.
The answer is simple, Komatsu said, still lightly waving his spoon. We put the two writers together and invent a brand new one. We add your perfect style to Fukaeri's raw story. It's an ideal combination. I know you've got it in you. Why do you think I've been backing you all this time? Just leave the rest to me. With the two of you together, the new writer's prize will be easy, and then we can shoot for the Akutagawa. I haven't been wasting my time in this business all these years. I know how to pull the right strings. Tengo let his lips part as he stared at Komatsu. Komatsu put his spoon back in his saucer. It made an abnormally loud sound.
Supposing the story wins the Akutagawa Prize, then what? Tengo asked, recovering from the shock.
If it takes the Akutagawa, it'll cause a sensation. Most people don't know the value of a good novel, but they don't want to be left out, so they'll buy it and read it, especially when they hear it was written by a high school girl. If the book sells, it'll make a lot of money. We'll split it three ways. I'll take care of that.
Never mind the money, Tengo said, his voice flat.
How about your professional ethics as an editor? If the scheme became public, it'd cause an uproar. You'd lose your job. It wouldn't come out so easily. I can handle the whole thing very carefully. And even if it did come out, I'd be glad to leave the company. Management doesn't like me, and they've never treated me decently. Finding another job would be no problem for me. Besides, I wouldn't be doing it for the money. I'd be doing it to screw the literary world. Those bastards all huddle together in their gloomy cave and kiss each other's asses and lick each other's wounds and trip each other up, all the while spewing this pompous crap about the mission of literature. I want to have a good laugh at their expense. I want to outwit the system and make idiots out of the whole bunch of them. Doesn't that sound like fun to you?
It did not sound like all that much fun to Tengo. For one thing, he had never actually seen this literary world, and when he realized that a competent individual like Komatsu had such childish motives for crossing such a dangerous bridge, he was momentarily at a loss for words.
"It sounds like a scam to me," he said at length. "Co-authorship is not that unusual," Komatsu said with a frown. "Half the magazine's serialized manga are co-authored. The staff toss around ideas and make up the story. The artist does simple line drawings. His assistants fill in the details and add color. It's not much different from the way a factory makes alarm clocks. The same sort of thing goes on in the fiction world. Romance novels, for example. With most of those, the publisher hires writers to make up stories following the guidelines they've established. Division of labor. That's the system. Mass production would be impossible any other way. In the self-conscious world of literary fiction, of course, such methods are not openly sanctioned, so as a practical strategy, we have to set Fukaeri up as our single author. If the deception comes out, it might cause a bit of a scandal, but we wouldn't be breaking the law. We'd just be riding the current of the times. And besides, we're not talking about a Balzac or a Murasaki Shikibu here. All we'd be doing is patching the holes in the story some high school girl wrote and making it a better piece of fiction. What's wrong with that? If the finished work is good and brings pleasure to a lot of readers, then no harm done. Don't you agree? Tengo gave some thought to what Komatsu was saying, and he answered with care. I see two problems here. I'm sure there are more than that, but for now let me concentrate on these two. One is that we don't know whether the author, Fuka Iri, would go along with having someone else rewrite her work. If she says no, of course, that's the end of that. The other problem, assuming she says okay, is whether I could really do a good job of rewriting it. Co-authorship is a very delicate matter. I can't believe things would go as easily as you are suggesting. I know you can do it, Tengo, Komatsu said without hesitation, as if he had been anticipating Tengo's reaction. I have no doubt whatever. I knew it the first time I read Air Chrysalis. The first thing that popped into my head was, Tengo has to rewrite this. It's perfect for you. It's aching for you to rewrite it, don't you see? Tengo merely shook his head, saying nothing. There's no rush, Komatsu said quietly. This is important. Take 2 or 3 days to think about it. Read Air Chrysalis again, and give some good, careful thought to what I'm proposing. And, oh yes, let me give you this. Komatsu withdrew a brown envelope from his breast pocket and handed it to Tengo. Inside the envelope were 2 standard-size color photos, pictures of a girl. One showed her from the chest up, the other was a full-length snapshot. They seemed to have been taken at the same time. She was standing in front of a stairway somewhere, a broad stone stairway. Classically beautiful features. Long, straight hair. White blouse, small and slim. Her lips were trying to smile, but her eyes were resisting. Serious eyes. Eyes in search of something. Tengo stared at the 2 photos. The more he looked, the more he thought about himself at that age, and the more he sensed a small, dull ache in his chest. It was a special ache, something he had not experienced for a very long time. "That's Fuka Iri," Komatsu said. "Beautiful girl, don't you think? Sweet and fresh. 17. Perfect. We won't tell anyone that her real name is Eriko Fukada. We'll keep her as Fuka Iri. The name alone should cause a stir if she wins the Akutagawa Prize, don't you think? She'll have reporters swarming around her like bats at sunset. The books'll sell out overnight." Tengo wondered how Komatsu had gotten hold of the photos. Entrants were not required to send in photos with their manuscripts. But he decided not to ask, partly because he didn't want to know the answer, whatever it might be. "You can keep those," Komatsu said. "They might come in handy." Tengo put them back into the envelope and laid them on the manuscript. Then he said to Komatsu, "I don't know much about how the industry works, but sheer common sense tells me this is a tremendously risky plan. Once you start lying to the public, you have to keep lying. It never ends. It's not easy, either psychologically or practically, to keep tweaking the truth to make it all fit together. If one person who's in on the plan makes one little slip, everybody could be done for. Don't you agree?" Komatsu pulled out another cigarette and lit it. "You're absolutely right. It is risky. There are a few too many uncertainties at this point in time. One slip and things could get very unpleasant for us. I'm perfectly aware of that. But you know, Tengo, taking everything into consideration, my instincts still tell me, go for it. For the simple reason that you don't get chances like this very often. I've never had one before, and I'm sure I'll never have another one." Comparing this to gambling might not be the best way to look at it. But we've got all the right cards and a mountain of chips. The conditions are perfect. If we let a chance like this slip away, we'll regret it for the rest of our lives. Tengo stared in silence at Komatsu's utterly sinister smile. Komatsu continued, And the most important thing is that we are remaking Air Chrysalis into a much better work. It's a story that should have been much better written. There's something important in it, something that needs someone to bring it out.
I'm sure you think so too, Tengo. Am I wrong? We each contribute our own special talents to the project. We pool our resources for one thing only, and that is to bring out that important something in the work. Our motives are pure. We can present them anywhere without shame.
Well, you can try to rationalize it all you want. You can invent all kinds of noble-sounding pretexts, but in the end, a scam is a scam.
Look, Tengo, you're losing sight of one crucial fact, Komatsu said, his mouth opening in a big, wide grin, the likes of which Tengo had never seen. Or should I say, you are deliberately choosing not to look at it. And that's the simple fact that you want to do this. You already feel that way. Risk and morality be damned. I can see it. You're itching to rewrite Air Chrysalis with your own hands. You want to be the one, not Fuka Eri, who brings out that special something in the work. I want you to go home now and figure out what you really think. Stand in front of a mirror and give yourself a long, hard look. It's written all over your face.
Tengo felt the air around him growing thin. He glanced at his surroundings. Was the image coming to him again? But no, there was no sign of it. The thinness of the air had come from something else. He pulled his handkerchief from his pocket and wiped the sweat from his brow. Komatsu was always right. Why should that be?
Chapter 3 Aomame Some Changed Facts Aomame climbed down the emergency stairway in her stocking feet. The wind whistled past the stairway, which was open to the elements. Snug though her miniskirt was, it filled like a sail with the occasional strong gust from below, providing enough lift to make her steps unsteady. She kept a tight grip on the cold metal pipe that served as a handrail, lowering herself a step at a time backward, and stopping now and then to brush aside the stray hair hanging down her forehead and to adjust the position of the shoulder bag slung diagonally across her chest. She had a sweeping view of National Highway 246 running below. The din of the city enveloped her, car engines, blaring horns, the scream of an automobile burglar alarm, an old war song echoing from a right-wing sound truck, a sledgehammer cracking concrete. Riding on the wind, the noise pressed in on her from all directions, above, below, and 360 degrees around. Listening to the racket, not that she wanted to listen, but she was in no position to be covering her ears, she began to feel almost seasick. Partway down, the stairs became a horizontal catwalk leading back toward the center of the elevated expressway, then angled straight down again. Just across the road from the open stairway stood a small 5-story apartment house, a relatively new building covered in brown brick tile. Each apartment had a small balcony facing the emergency stairway, but all the patio doors were shut tight, the blinds or curtains closed. What kind of architect puts balconies on a building that stands nose to nose with an elevated expressway? No one would be hanging out their sheets to dry or lingering on the balcony with a gin and tonic to watch the evening rush hour traffic. Still, on several balconies were stretched the seemingly obligatory nylon clotheslines, and one even had a garden chair and potted rubber plant. The rubber plant was ragged and faded, its leaves disintegrating and marked with brown, dry spots. Aomame could not help feeling sorry for the plant. If she were ever reincarnated, let her not be reborn as such a miserable rubber plant. Judging from the spider webs clinging to it, the emergency stairway was hardly ever used. To each web clung a small black spider, patiently waiting for its small prey to come along. Not that the spiders had any awareness of being patient. A spider had no special skill other than building its web, and no lifestyle choice other than sitting still. It would stay in one place, waiting for its prey until, in the natural course of things, it shriveled up and died. This was all genetically predetermined. The spider had no confusion, no despair, no regrets, no metaphysical doubt, no moral complications. Probably. Unlike me, I have to move with a purpose, which is why I'm alone now, climbing down these stupid emergency stairs from Metropolitan Expressway No. 3, where it passes through the useless Sanganjaya neighborhood, even if it means ruining a perfectly good pair of stockings, all the while sweeping away these damned spider webs and looking at an ugly rubber plant on somebody's stupid balcony. I move, therefore I am. Climbing down the stairway, Ah Mame thought about Tamaki Otsuka. She had not been intending to think about Tamaki, but once the thoughts began, she couldn't stop them. Tamaki was her closest friend in high school and a fellow member of the softball team. As teammates, they went to many different places and did all kinds of things together. They once shared a kind of lesbian experience. The two of them took a summer trip and ended up sleeping together when a small double was the only size bed the hotel could offer. They found themselves touching each other all over. Neither of them was a lesbian, but, spurred on by the special curiosity of two young girls, they experimented boldly. Neither had a boyfriend at the time, and neither had the slightest sexual experience. It was simply one of those things that remain as an exceptional but interesting episode in life. But as she brought back the images of herself and Tamaki touching each other that night, Ah Mame felt some small, deep part of herself growing hot even as she made her way down the windswept stairway. Tamaki's oval-shaped nipples, her sparse pubic hair, the lovely curve of her buttocks, the shape of her clitoris. Ah Mame recalled them all with strange clarity. As her mind traced these graphic memories, the brass unison of Janacek's Sinfonietta rang like festive background music. The palm of her hand was caressing the curve of Tamaki's waist. At first, Tamaki just laughed, as if she were being tickled, but soon the laughter stopped, and her breathing changed. The music had initially been composed as a fanfare for an athletic meet. The breeze blew gently over the green meadows of Bohemia in time with the music. Ah Mame knew when Tamaki's nipples suddenly became erect. And then her own did the same. And then the timpani conjured up a complex musical pattern. Ah Mame halted her steps and shook her head several times. I should not be thinking such thoughts at a time like this. I have to concentrate on climbing down the stairs. But the thoughts would not go away. The images came to her one after another and with great vividness. The summer night, the narrow bed, the faint smell of perspiration, the words they spoke, the feelings that would not take the form of words, forgotten promises, unrealized hopes, frustrated longings. A gust of wind lifted a lock of her hair and whipped it against her cheek. The pain brought a film of tears to her eyes. Successive gusts soon dried the tears away. When did that happen, I wonder? But time became confused in her memory, like a tangled string. The straight line axis was lost, and forward and back, right and left, jumbled together. One drawer took the place of another. She could not recall things that should have come back to her easily. It is now April 1984. I was born in... that's it, 1954. I can remember that much. These dates were engraved in her mind, but as soon as she recalled them, they lost all meaning. She saw white cards imprinted with dates scattering in the wind, flying in all directions. She ran, trying to pick up as many as she could, but the wind was too strong, the sheer number of cards overwhelming. Away they flew. 1954, 1984, 1645, 1881, 2006, 771, 2041. All order lost, all knowledge vanishing, the stairway of intellection crumbling beneath her feet. Aomame and Tamaki were in bed together. They were 17 and enjoying their newly granted freedom. This was their first trip together as friends, just the two of them. That fact alone was exciting. They soaked in the hotel's hot spring, split a can of beer from the refrigerator, turned out the lights, and crawled into bed. They were just kidding around at first, poking each other for the fun of it. But at some point, Tamaki reached out and grabbed Aomame's nipple through the t-shirt she wore as pajamas. An electric shock ran through Aomame's body. Eventually, they stripped off their shirts and panties and were naked in the summer night. Where did we go on that trip? She could not recall. It didn't matter. Soon, without either of them being the first to suggest it, they were examining each other's bodies down to the smallest detail. Looking, touching, caressing, kissing, licking, half in jest, half seriously. Tamaki was small and a bit plump with large breasts. Aomame was taller, lean and muscular with smaller breasts. Tamaki always talked about going on a diet, but Aomame found her attractive just the way she was. Tamaki's skin was soft and fine. Her nipples swelled in a beautiful oval shape reminiscent of olives. Her pubic hair was fine and sparse, like a delicate willow tree. Aomame's was hard and bristly. They laughed at the difference. They experimented with touching each other in different places and discussed which areas were the most sensitive. Some areas were the same, others were not. Each held out a finger and touched the other's clitoris. Both girls had experienced masturbation. A lot. But now they saw how different it was to be touched by someone else. The breeze swept across the meadows of Bohemia. Aomame came to a stop and shook her head again. She released a deep sigh and tightened her grip on the metal pipe handrail. I have to stop thinking about these things. I have to concentrate on climbing down the stairs. By now I must be more than halfway down. Still, why is there so much noise here? Why is the wind so strong? They both seem to be reprimanding me, punishing me. Setting such immediate sensory impressions aside, Aomame began to worry about what might await her at the bottom of the stairway. What if someone were there, demanding that she identify herself and explain her presence? Could she get by with a simple explanation? The traffic was backed up on the expressway and I have such urgent business that I climbed down the stairs. Or would there be complications? She didn't want any complications. Not today. Fortunately, she found no one at ground level to challenge her. The first thing she did was pull her shoes from her bag and step into them. The stairway came down to a vacant patch beneath the elevated expressway, a storage area for construction materials hemmed in between the inbound and outbound lanes of Route 246 and surrounded by high metal sheeting. A number of steel poles lay on the bare ground, rusting, probably discarded surplus from some construction job. A makeshift plastic roof covered one part of the area, where three cloth sacks lay piled. Aomame had no idea what they held, but they had been further protected from the rain by a vinyl cover. The sacks, too, seemed to be construction surplus, thrown there at the end of the job because they were too much trouble to haul away. Beneath the roof, several crushed corrugated cartons, some plastic drink bottles, and a number of manga magazines lay on the ground. Aside from a few plastic shopping bags that were being whipped around by the wind, there was nothing else down here. The area had a metal gate, but a large padlock and several wrappings of chain held it in place. The gate towered over her and was topped with barbed wire. There was no way she could climb over it. Even if she managed to do so, her suit would be torn to shreds. She gave it a few tentative shakes, but it wouldn't budge. There was not even enough space for a cat to squeeze through. Damn. What was the point of locking the place so securely? There was nothing here worth stealing. She frowned and cursed, and even spit on the ground. After all her trouble to climb down from the elevated expressway, now she was locked in a storage yard. She glanced at her watch. The time was still okay, but she couldn't go on hanging around in this place forever. And doubling back to the expressway now was out of the question. The heels of both her stockings were ripped. Checking to make sure that there was no one watching her, she slipped out of her high heels, rolled up her skirt, pulled her stockings down, yanked them off her feet, and stepped into her shoes again. The torn stockings she shoved into her bag. This calmed her somewhat. Now she walked the perimeter of the storage area, paying close attention to every detail. It was about the size of an elementary school classroom, so a full circuit of the place took no time at all. Yes, she had already found the only exit, the locked gate. The metal sheeting that enclosed the space was thin, but the pieces were securely bolted together, and the bolts could not be loosened without tools. Time to give up. She went over to the roofed area for a closer look at the crushed cartons. They had been arranged as bedding, she realized, with a number of worn blankets rolled up inside. They were not all that old either. Some street people were probably sleeping here, which explained the bottles and magazines. No doubt about it. All Mame put her mind to work. If they were using this place to spend their nights, it must have some kind of secret entrance. They're good at finding hidden places to ward off the wind and rain, she thought. And they know how to secure secret passageways, like animal trails, for their exclusive use. Almame made another round, closely inspecting each metal sheet of the fence and giving it a shake. As she expected, she found one loose spot where a bolt might have slipped out. She tried bending it in different directions. If you change the angle a little and pulled it inward, a space opened up that was just big enough for a person to squeeze through. The street people probably came in after dark to enjoy sleeping under the roof, but they would have problems if someone caught them in there. So they went out during the daylight hours to find food and collect empty bottles for spare change. Almame inwardly thanked the nameless nighttime residents. As someone who had to move stealthily, anonymously, behind the scenes in the big city, she felt at one with them. She crouched down and slipped through the narrow gap, taking great care to avoid catching and tearing her expensive suit on any sharp objects. It was not her favorite suit. It was the only one she owned. She almost never dressed this way, and she never wore heels. Sometimes, however, this particular line of work required her to dress respectably, so she had to avoid ruining the suit. Fortunately, there was no one outside the fence either. She checked her clothing once more, resumed a calm expression on her face, and walked to a corner with a traffic signal. Crossing Route 246, she entered a drugstore and bought a new pair of stockings, which she put on in a back room with the permission of the girl at the register. This improved her mood considerably and obliterated the slight discomfort, like seasickness, that had remained in her stomach. Thanking the clerk, she left the store. The traffic on Route 246 was heavier than usual, probably because word had spread that an accident had stopped traffic on the parallel urban expressway. Al-Mama abandoned the idea of taking a cab and decided instead to take the Tokyushin Tamagawa line from a nearby station. That would be a sure thing. She had had enough of taxis stuck in traffic. As she headed for Sangenjaya Station, she passed a policeman on the street. He was a tall young officer, walking rapidly, heading somewhere in particular. She tensed up for a moment, but he looked straight ahead, apparently in too much of a hurry even to glance at her. Just before they passed each other, Al-Mama noticed that there was something unusual about his uniform. The jacket was the normal deep navy blue, but its cut was different. The design was more casual, less tight-fitting, and in a softer material. The lapels smaller, even the navy color a touch paler. His pistol, too, was a different model. He wore a large automatic at his waist instead of the revolver normally issued to policemen in Japan. Crimes involving firearms were so rare in this country that there was little likelihood that an officer would be caught in a shootout, which meant an old-fashioned six-shooter was adequate. Revolvers were simply made, cheap, reliable, and easy to maintain. But for some reason, this officer was carrying the latest model semi-automatic pistol, the kind that could be loaded with 16 9mm bullets, probably a Glock or a Beretta. But how could that be? How could police uniforms and pistols have changed without her being aware of it? It was practically unthinkable. She read the newspaper closely each day. Changes like that would have been featured prominently. And besides, she paid careful attention to police uniforms. Until this morning, just a few hours ago, policemen were still wearing the same old stiff uniforms they always had, and still carrying the same old unsophisticated revolvers. She remembered them clearly. It was very strange. But Al-Mama was in no frame of mind to think deeply about such matters. She had a job to do. When the subway reached Shibuya Station, she deposited her coat in a coin locker, then hurried up Dogenzaka toward the hotel wearing only her suit. It was a decent enough hotel, nothing fancy, but well-equipped, clean, with reputable guests. It had a restaurant on the street level, as well as a convenience store, close to the station, a good location. She walked in and headed straight for the ladies' room. Fortunately, it was empty. The first thing she did was sit down for a good long pee. Eyes closed, listening to the sound like distant surf, and thinking of nothing in particular. Next, she stood at one of the sinks and washed her hands well with soap and water. She brushed her hair and blew her nose. She took out her toothbrush and did a cursory brushing without toothpaste. She had no time to floss. It wasn't that important. She wasn't preparing for a date. She faced the mirror and added a touch of lipstick and eyebrow pencil. Removing her suit jacket, she adjusted the position of her underwire bra, smoothed the wrinkles in her white blouse, and sniffed her armpits. No smell. Then she closed her eyes and recited the usual prayer, the words of which meant nothing. The meaning didn't matter. Reciting was the important thing. After the prayer, she opened her eyes and looked at herself in the mirror. Fine. The picture of the capable businesswoman. Erect posture, firm mouth. Only the big, bulky shoulder bag seemed out of place. A slim attaché case might have been better, but this bag was more practical. She checked again to make sure she had all the items she needed in the bag. No problem. Everything was where it belonged. Easy to find by touch. Now it was just a matter of carrying out the task as arranged, head on, with unwavering conviction and ruthlessness. Al-Mama undid the top button of her blouse. This would give a glimpse of cleavage when she bent over. If only she had more cleavage to expose. No one challenged her, as she took the elevator to the fourth floor, walked down the corridor, and quickly found room 426. Taking a clipboard from the bag, she clutched it to her chest and knocked on the door. A light, crisp knock. A brief wait. Another knock, this one a little harder. Grumbling from inside. Door opened a crack. Man's face, maybe 40. Marine blue shirt, gray flannel slacks. Classic look of a businessman working with his tie and jacket off. Red eyes, annoyed. Probably sleep-deprived. He seemed surprised to see Al-Mama in her business suit, probably expecting her to be a maid here to replenish the minibar. "I'm terribly sorry to disturb you, sir. My name is Ito, and I'm a member of the hotel management staff. There's been a problem with the air conditioner, and I need to do an inspection. May I come in? It won't take more than 5 minutes." Al-Mama announced briskly, with a sweet smile. The man squinted at her in obvious displeasure. "I'm working on something important, a rush job. I'll be leaving the room in another hour. Can I get you to come back then? There's nothing wrong with the air conditioner in this room." "I'm terribly sorry, sir. It's an emergency involving a short circuit. We need to take care of it as soon as possible for safety's sake. We're going from room to room. It won't even take 5 minutes." "Ah, what the hell," the man said with a click of his tongue. "I made a point of taking a room so I could work undisturbed." He pointed to the papers on the desk, a pile of detailed charts and graphs he had printed out, probably materials he was preparing for a late meeting. He had a computer and a calculator, and scratch paper with long lines of figures. Al-Mama knew that he worked for a corporation connected with oil. He was a specialist on capital investment in a number of Middle Eastern countries. According to the information she had been given, he was one of the more capable men in the field. She could see it in the way he carried himself. He came from a good family, earned a sizable income, and drove a new Jaguar. After a pampered childhood, he had gone to study abroad, spoke good English and French, and exuded self-confidence. He was the type who could not bear to be told what to do, or to be criticized, especially if the criticism came from a woman. He had no difficulty bossing others around, though, and cracking a few of his wife's ribs with a golf club was no problem at all. As far as he was concerned, the world revolved around him, and without him, the earth didn't move at all. He could become furious, violently angry, if anyone interfered with what he was doing or contradicted him in any way. "Sorry to trouble you, sir," Al-Mama said, flashing him her best business smile. As if it were a fait accompli, she squeezed halfway into the room, pressing her back against the door, readied her clipboard, and started writing something on it with a ballpoint pen. "That was, Mr. Miyama, I believe," she asked. Having seen his photo any number of times, she knew his face well, but it wouldn't hurt to make sure she had the right person. There was no way to correct a mistake. "Yes, of course, Miyama," he said curtly. He followed this with a resigned sigh that seemed to say, "All right, do as you damn please." He took his seat at the desk, and with a ballpoint pen in one hand, picked up whatever document he had been reading. His suit coat and a striped tie lay on the fully made double bed where he had thrown them. They were both obviously very expensive. Al-Mama walked straight for the closet, her bag hanging from her shoulder. She had been told that the air conditioner switch panel was in there. Inside, she found a trench coat of soft material and a dark gray cashmere scarf. The only luggage was a leather briefcase. No change of clothes, no bag for toiletries. He was probably not planning to stay the night. On the desk stood a coffee pot that had obviously been delivered by room service. She pretended to inspect the switch panel for 30 seconds and then called out to Miyama. "Thank you, Mr. Miyama, for your cooperation. I can't find any problem with the equipment in this room. Which is what I was trying to tell you from the start, he grumbled. Mr. Miyama, she ventured. Excuse me, but I think you have something stuck to the back of your neck. The back of my neck? He said. He rubbed the area and then stared at the palm of his hand. I don't think so. Please just let me have a look, she said, drawing closer. Do you mind? Sure, go ahead, he said, looking puzzled. What is it? A spot of paint, I think. Bright green. Paint? I'm not really sure. Judging from the color, it has to be paint. Is it all right if I touch you back there? It may come right off. Well, okay, Miyama said, ducking his head forward, exposing the back of his neck to Aomame. It was bare, thanks to what looked like a recent haircut. Aomame took a deep breath and held it, concentrating her attention on her finger's nimble search for the right spot. She pressed a fingertip there as if to mark the place, then closed her eyes, confirming that her touch was not mistaken. Yes, this is it. I'd like to take more time if possible to make doubly certain, but it's too late for that now. I'll just have to do my best with the situation I've been given. Sorry, sir, but do you mind holding that position a bit longer? I'll take a penlight from my bag. The lighting in here is not very good. Why would I have paint back there, of all things? I have no idea, sir. I'll check it right away. Keeping her finger pressed against the spot on the man's neck, Aomame drew a hard plastic case from her bag, opened it, and took out an object wrapped in thin cloth. With a few deft moves, she unfolded the cloth, revealing something like a small ice pick, about 4 inches in length, with a compact wooden handle. It looked like an ice pick, but it was not meant for cracking ice. Aomame had designed and made it herself. The tip was as sharp and pointed as a needle, and it was protected from breakage by a small piece of cork. Cork that had been specially processed to make it as soft as cotton. She carefully plucked the cork from the point and slipped it into her pocket. She then held the exposed point against that special spot on Miyama's neck. Calm down now. This is it, Aomame told herself. I can't be off by even 1/100 of an inch. One slip and all my efforts will be wasted. Concentration is the key. How much longer is this going to take? Miyama protested. I'm sorry, sir. I'll be through in a moment. Don't worry, she said to him silently. It'll all be over before you know it. Wait just a second or two. Then you won't have to think about a thing. You won't have to think about the oil refining system, or crude oil market trends, or quarterly reports to the investors, or Bahrain flight reservations, or bribes for officials or presents for your mistress. What a strain it must have been for you to keep these things straight in your head all this time. So please, just wait a minute. I'm hard at work here, giving it all the concentration I can muster. Don't distract me. That's all I ask. Once she had settled on the location and set her mind to the task, Aomame raised her right palm in the air, held her breath, and, after a brief pause, brought it straight down, not too forcefully, against the wooden handle. If she applied too much force, the needle might break under the skin, and leaving the needle tip behind was out of the question. The important thing was to bring the palm down lightly, almost tenderly, at exactly the right angle with exactly the right amount of force, without resisting gravity, straight down, as if the fine point of the needle were being sucked into the spot with the utmost naturalness, deeply, smoothly, and with fatal results. The angle and force, or rather the restraint of force, were crucial. As long as she was careful about those details, it was as simple as driving a needle into a block of tofu. The needle pierced the skin, thrust into the special spot at the base of the brain, and stopped the heart as naturally as blowing out a candle. Everything ended in a split second, almost too easily. Only Al-Mame could do this. No one else could find that subtle point by touch. Her fingertips possessed the special intuition that made it possible. She heard him draw a sharp breath, and then every muscle in his body went stiff. Instantly, she withdrew the needle and just as quickly took out the small gauze pad she had ready in her pocket, pressing it against the wound to prevent the flow of blood. Because the needle was so fine and had remained in his skin for no more than a few seconds, only a minuscule amount of blood could possibly escape through the opening, but she had to take every precaution. She must not leave even the slightest trace of blood. One drop could ruin everything. Caution was Al-Mama's specialty. The strength began to drain from Miyama's body, which had momentarily stiffened, like air going out of a basketball. Keeping her finger on the spot on his neck, Al-Mame let him slump forward onto the desk. His face lay sideways, pillowed on his documents. His eyes were wide open in apparent surprise, as if his last act had been to witness something utterly amazing. They showed neither fear nor pain, only pure surprise. Something out of the ordinary was happening to him, but he could not comprehend what it was. A pain? An itch? A pleasure or a divine revelation? There are many different ways of dying in the world, perhaps none of them as easy as this. "This was an easier death than you deserved," Al-Mamet thought with a scowl. "It was just too simple. I probably should have broken a few ribs for you with a 5-iron and given you plenty of pain before putting you out of your misery. That would have been the right kind of death for a rat like you. It's what you did to your wife. Unfortunately, however, the choice was not mine. My mission was to send this man to the other world as swiftly and surely and discreetly as possible. Now, I have accomplished that mission. He was alive until a moment ago, and now he's dead. He crossed the threshold separating life from death without being aware of it himself." Al-Mame held the gauze in place for a full 5 minutes, patiently, but without pressing hard enough for her finger to leave an indentation. She kept her eyes glued on the second hand of her watch. It was a very long 5 minutes. If someone had walked in then and seen her pressing her finger against the man's neck while holding the slender murder weapon in the other hand, it would have been all over. She could never have talked her way out of it. A bellhop could bring a pot of coffee. There could be a knock on the door at any moment. But this was an indispensable 5 minutes. To calm herself, Al-Mame took several slow, deep breaths. "I can't get flustered now. I can't lose my composure. I have to stay the same calm, cool Al-Mame as always." She could hear her heart beating, and in her head, in time with the beat, resounded the opening fanfare of Janacek's Sinfonietta. Soft, silent breezes played across the green meadows of Bohemia. She was aware that she had become split in two. Half of her continued to press the dead man's neck with utter coolness. The other half was filled with fear. She wanted to drop everything and get out of this room now. "I'm here, but I'm not here. I'm in two places at once. It goes against Einstein's theorem. But what the hell? Call it the Zen of the killer." The 5 minutes were finally up, but just to make sure, Al-Mame gave it one more minute. "I can wait another minute. The greater the rush, the more care one should take with the job." She endured the extra minute, which seemed as if it would never end. Then, She slowly pulled her finger away and examined the wound with her penlight. A mosquito stinger left a larger hole than this. Stabbing the special point at the base of the brain with an exceptionally fine needle,